Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power.
And now, here's Al Gore's Midnight Massage Man, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I'm Mark Gillar. Our special guest today is Shannon Gessling from the Southeastern Legal Foundation in Atlanta, Georgia. Shannon is the Executive Director and Chief Legal Counsel for the Southeastern Legal Foundation. She has also worked as a district attorney in the metro Atlanta area, prosecuting crimes against women and children, and has essentially spent her career working toward limited government, law and order, and the enhancement of constitutional liberties. Shannon, welcome to the show. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate you having me today.
Oh, fantastic. Now, we first gained interest in you and your organization because of your lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency to keep them from regulating CO2 and other greenhouse gases as pollution, if you can believe that. And I'm wondering if you would just kind of give us some background with that, maybe going all the way back to the Supreme Court case of Massachusetts versus the EPA, and sort of bring us forward through Senator Murkowski's efforts, and then tell us where things are now.
You bet. Well, going backward, Mass versus EPA is the case that almost everybody knows about, where the Environmental Protection Agency basically didn't defend the way that they should have. We like to look at it as sort of a complicit lawsuit, where they never challenged Massachusetts when Massachusetts said that there was a human causation for global warming. And they didn't fight very much when they were talking about carbon dioxide being a pollutant or having to be analyzed. The Supreme Court had a very limited record as a result and ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency had a duty to go through the process to determine whether carbon dioxide was in fact a pollutant. If it was a pollutant, was it harmful to human health and welfare? And if so, to what extent, and whether it should be regulated, and if yes, then to what extent it should be regulated. Very reasonable, even if you disagree with the premise that it's a pollutant, which, of course, we do. So the Environmental Protection Agency, after basically not putting up a good fight, acquiesced to getting their hat handed to them, and then goes through the what I like to call the pretend process of analyzing whether it's a pollutant. Surprise, surprise, they determined that CO2 is in fact a pollutant. They make this fabulous endangerment finding, which from the records we've seen, it looks like they made that decision about 10 years ago rather than recently and based on recent evidence. And they didn't rely on the science of recent science or science that was produced and analyzed by the American agency, but relied on the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And why do we care about that? Well, the United States government is not supposed to rely on outside sources, specifically when it comes to our regulations. And so they're violating their own policy. Why does that matter here? Because we all saw in December of 2009, ClimateGate, which was basically the fraud that was disclosed in those emails. Right after that, you saw AmazonGate and HimalayaGate, which demonstrated that there was misinformation, potentially fraudulent information, by the scientists who participated in the IPCC. So what you have the United States government federal agency making a decision based on other people and other scientists and other countries' activities and national organizations that's premised on basically bad conduct. We rely on bad conduct, we make a bad decision, and the decision is basically to regulate carbon dioxide in the United States as if that's going to have an effect worldwide. And not only did the Environmental Protection Agency violate their own procedures, but they're making decisions based on politics, not sound scientific foundation. Not anything we want our federal government to be doing, and as a result, Southeastern Legal Foundation, on behalf of 17 members of Congress, agricultural representatives, trucking representatives, manufacturing representatives here in Georgia, we challenged, actually we have four lawsuits and one administrative action going, all against the Environmental Protection Agency, all based on the fact that the Environmental Protection Agency has basically acted in bad faith, violated their own procedures, and are basically making decisions and regulating that are going to cost the American people trillions, upward of $1 trillion, as if our economy can take it. And that's in a nutshell since 2002.
Well, let me pretend I work for the other side for a minute. What you're going to hear is that two independent investigations have found that there was nothing that these scientists did wrong in the so-called or alleged ClimateGate scandal. The UK Parliament has found that the UK boys did nothing wrong. The University of Pennsylvania has found that their boy, Michael Mann, when he was there, did nothing wrong. So all these independent investigations where people essentially investigated themselves found that there was nothing wrong.
Actually, the Parliament referred it to their scientific committee for further investigation, and that the decision you heard was more of a political response rather than the scientific response, and the scientists are actually still under investigation by their own organizations because there is conduct that scientists, the scientific method, how they're supposed to conduct themselves, how they're supposed to manage grants, how they're supposed to manage data, how they're supposed to do analysis, that's all controlled within the scientific community at large, and you're supposed to follow all their rules. So I would tell you that I have little or no concern that the Parliament has made a declaration because that's political, just like the President of the United States has said that there's global warming. Thank you very much. That's not an answer. That's not a scientific answer, and that's not going to be anything that I'm going to rely on. And, of course, University of Pennsylvania is going to want to protect one of their most esteemed professors. But again, that's not an independent investigation, and we're interested in what the record reflects. And independent analysis of those emails indicates a very different result. And I will tell you that the IPCC investigative team has come to different initial conclusions, and it's actually resulted in the resignation of many of the top people who were on the IPCC. And I think most people would be interested. They've resigned, and what have they gone to do? They've gone to be consultants for corporations to help them find green ways to produce energy, et cetera, to the tune of millions of dollars. So I think that it's great because let me think, how do I make millions of dollars? I declare worldwide that there's a worldwide problem. I'm an expert. Uh-huh. After I create the problem and convince everybody, I'm going to quit my job and go work for the companies that are negatively affected, and they're going to pay me millions of dollars so I can help solve their problems. Great.
Well, it's good money if you can get it, but if you can get it. when you were saying that, I had this image in my head of the government hiring all these hacker kids to go to work for the government to catch other hackers. It sort of seems like it's sort of the same thing. Now, one of the things that for me seems an easy way to convince the layperson that CO2 is not pollution is one, commercial greenhouses pump this stuff into their greenhouses because it has such a beneficial impact on plants. And by beneficial impact, I'm talking about they need less water, they're more heat resistant, they bear more fruit, larger fruit, juicier fruit. And if there's one particular website, I can't remember which one, but you can actually look at two plants planted at the exact same time, one having a parts per million of about 400, which is only slightly higher than what we see in our atmosphere, of CO2, and the other contained area for the second plant has a CO2 level of about 1,200, 1,260 parts per million. And as the two plants grow, you can see this enormous difference between the two plants. The one in the higher CO2 environment does much, much better, and one has to ask, since when do commercial greenhouses pump pollution into their greenhouses in order to benefit their plants? I can't imagine something this beneficial to plants being labeled as a pollutant. It violates every rule of common sense. What are your thoughts?
I just have to agree wholeheartedly. And we learned in our middle school and elementary and high school science classes that carbon dioxide is food for plants. Plants must produce oxygen that we live on. And I think one of the me making light on radio is for entertainment for people who are listening, just maybe grab them. But it is a serious issue because when our federal government and or world government organizations are seeking to do something that's contrary to our well-being, our physical well-being, and that's really what this is about. It's not just contrary to our economic well-being, and it is that. But it's about, as parents, as grandparents, is the federal government taking an action that is beneficial to my child or to our grandchildren, or are they taking an action that's detrimental? And it is detrimental, and the focus isn't on what's good for us as a community, as a country. The focus seems to be on money, which means that if carbon dioxide is being emitted by a cow's butt, and we're not going to regulate the cow butt, but we are going to regulate the refinery. It's the same carbon dioxide, but the guy who owns 20 cows, right, who's producing this bad carbon dioxide out of a cow's butt, we're not going to regulate him, but we are going to regulate the multinational publicly traded corporation because they're a deep pocket. We're going to tax them. And we're going to take money from them, and we're going to use that money for all of our political agendas. I have no objection to having political agendas. I have no objection to declaring outright that I have a political agenda, or the president has a political agenda, or a congressman has a political agenda. But let's be honest about it. Let's be honest about why we're doing what we're doing. And if you can convince the American people and or Congress or the president to take that action and be forthright about it, more power to you. But don't do it surreptitiously. Don't do it based on bad science. Don't do it based on potential fraud. And don't lie to me about it. That's my problem. My federal government isn't supposed to lie to me, isn't supposed to try to manipulate me, and isn't supposed to try to do damage to my child or, anybody's children or grandchildren. And that's what's being done here. And it is absurd. It is contrary to everything that we know. And most people, I will tell you, are now getting it. It's taken a few years, but people are now paying attention to the fact that because we're not seeing global warming, right, because these are natural fluctuations in the planet, and nobody buys it anymore. They basically know it's a total crock. And so that's why you don't have Congress taking action, because if they vote for it, they're going to get what we'll call not elected in 2010. And that's why the president has forced the Environmental Protection Agency, because if you can't convince Congress, who is responsive to the public, then let's do it based on an agency protocol, and which forces us to go to court, which we are.
Let's talk about the money aspect of it for a minute, just to let the listeners
sure.
know how much money is involved here. Now, one of the things we've heard is that if the U.S. signs on to a cap and trade agreement, one, the taxes brought in the United States alone are going to equal the amount of money the federal government gets from the corporate income tax, and of course we know that always trickles down to the consumer, so basically it's going to mean less money for the average individual. Secondly, Wall Street people project that if it goes through, and if there is in fact an international agreement, if they're able to push through that Kyoto-style agreement and the U.S. signs on and all the major countries sign on, that carbon dioxide will be the most highly traded commodity in the world. And let's think about that for a minute. That means more than gold, more than silver, more than the proverbial pork bellies. I mean, more than everything, the most highly traded commodity in the world. We're talking huge bucks here, aren't we?
Oh, we are. Huge. It's a big, big deal. Right now it's already being traded, but the part that everybody should think is real strange is how do you prove that you have pursued a particular endeavor that either reduces carbon dioxide or captures carbon dioxide? At this point, best practices don't even allow for such a tracking. And in fact, there's this entire industry that most people probably don't realize that trying to get certified to be a carbon dioxide greenhouse gas analyzer reporter with actually no basis, which means you, people who own timberland, they say if you don't cut your timber for 50 acres of your timber for this period of time, we believe that this amount of carbon dioxide will be it'll be reduced by this amount, so we're going to give you money. And then we're going to sell your credits on the open market. Okay, that makes no sense whatsoever, but all right, that's what they're doing right now. And the market in Europe that already exists is it's actually kind of no basis in reality. I will point out that even if you did have a Kyoto-style international agreement, China and India are in the middle of an international, are in the middle of their industrial revolution. They are not going to modify what they're doing, period. Which means that the United States and or some other countries are going to be standing alone, and two of the largest countries that are producing the most carbon dioxide are not going to modify their conduct. But let's take a look at it from a big global picture. Let's take the United States, instead of being an independent actor, we're a world citizen. If everybody in the world today, every industry, every person, we turned off our lights, we stopped driving our cars, we turned off our computers and our phones, and we stopped producing anything except for that which we could produce by hand. No tractors to produce to till the cornfields, et cetera. Okay, if we did that right now, and we did that for 100 years, it would change the world temperature by less than 1 degree Celsius.
Sounds worth it to me.
It's absurd. If you could do something that had value, and I can't even assume it, but let's assume for a moment we could make positive changes, because I believe in good corporate citizenship of the planet and of the country. You're supposed to do things safely. You're supposed to do things cleanly. You're supposed to use best practices. All of these make sense. But there are enough things out there that are harmful, that need to be dealt with, hello, Gulf of Mexico, that we don't need to make up pollutants. We don't need to make up doing things. There's enough bad in the world that we can put all of our energy towards that, and I mean human energy and corporate money and all of those things. We can take care of things that are wrong, but don't make up things that are wrong so that you can make money. It's disingenuous, it's unethical, and it's sad.
One of the things that bothers me about this is that for a fraction of what the world would spend trying to reduce temperature by 1 or 2 degrees Celsius over the next 100 years, depending on who you talk to, we could address some of the problems directly. You know, I mean, there's so many things that they say are being caused by global warming, so many environmental issues. And I think it was Bjorn Lomborg who first pointed out that, you know, for pennies on the dollar, essentially, we could address environmental concerns with direct action now, as opposed to trying to cut temperature by a couple degrees. Now, you mentioned the European system and how there's no rhyme or reason to it, much as corruption pretty much finds its way into anything. What I've heard, and I'd like your comment to see if you've been hearing this as well, is that in Europe, the industries that, you know, belly up to the bar and give a lot of political contributions are given these enormous CO2 or carbon caps. But the industries that don't have theirs relatively restricted, with the idea that the good industries that support the politicians will have plenty of credits at the end of the year to sell to the industries who do not. I mean, that's one of the things I'm hearing, is that there's complete corruption in terms of which industries get how big a cap and which industries are being punished by lower caps so that they have to buy credits from the industries that are supporting the politicians with donations. And that's already crept into the European system. I don't see anything you could do to keep this in the United States from becoming as equally corrupt.
Well, I don't doubt it at all. And besides that, you already have it. We have this thing called the four things that have occurred is you have the endangerment finding. You have this thing called the Johnson Memo, which changes basically pre-existing laws to when a rule or regulation becomes effective. Then you have this tailpipe rule, which has to do with car emissions and also will affect stationary sources. And the last one is this thing called the tailoring rule. The tailoring rule has modified the Clean Air Act without the approval of Congress, without the approval of the President of the United States, which is utterly contrary to law. And they've said, we're not going to affect all of the businesses that the Clean Air Act say should be affected by our conclusion. We're going to only impact the large producers. So you already have that. You already have picking and choosing. When in fact, if any business produces carbon dioxide, and the conclusion, though we believe it to be wrong and have evidence that it's a wrong conclusion, carbon dioxide produced by anyone is, if it's harmful, then it should be regulated. Why are they picking a certain category except for the one reason you have, which is corruption and going for the deep pocket? If there is a modification of conduct that needs to happen in the United States of America, then it's across the board. And that's why you know that it's not really valid. That if we all don't have to change our conduct, but only the companies that are manufacturing large, and they're actually picking and choosing which manufacturing, that tells you that it's not actually a problem. It's only that they're picking and choosing because we know where all the money is. And that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about protecting our children, our grandchildren, our communities. We're talking about money.
What's interesting is that even the scientists who lend their support to anthropogenic global warming theory will tell you that water vapor is a much more potent greenhouse gas and is a much bigger problem. But no one has figured out how to regulate water vapor and make money off of it. So that's been completely untouched, which I think is absolutely ridiculous. That's a clear sign that this is all about the money.
Right. And that's the part that I think the average person gets it, and they're getting it more and more. That and that's why I think in many ways we're not only going to win politically, we're gonna win based on public knowledge, public education, that level of campaign. But I think in the end, based on very good case law, that we'll win in court. It's going to be a long fight, but it's a fight worth having. It's important that that we have our clients, and Southeastern Legal Foundation is working diligently with all the other petitioners as well. But we are going to have the opportunity to point out the deficiency of the Environmental Protection Agency's action. And if that means we take it all the way up to the United States Supreme Court on behalf of the United States people, then we will. And hopefully we will be victorious there. But we are not going to be idle. We are not going to accept the absurdity of this, and I'm certainly, as a mom, I'm not going to allow anybody to lie to me and take away my rights and to use their authority and be abusive and do damage to the economy that I rely on and everybody else relies on. We need to take care of the United States economy, and we need to be a good participant in the world economy, but we do not need to be making absurd decisions that are detrimental across the board.
Well, mentioning that you're a mom actually provides me the perfect segue into what was going to be my next question and still is, and that is another place that this battle is taking place is in our academic institutions. I mean, really, literally from kindergarten on up. And one of the things that just drives me crazy is that, that little sci-fi horror comedy flick, Al Gore's PowerPoint presentation, and Inconvenient Truth, is being shown at numerous grade levels, again, starting probably in grade school and going on up, without any type of balance whatsoever. And there are some efforts being made. Joanne Nova in Australia has put together this great handbook that works well in the schools. If you know Phelan McAleer and Ann McElhaney, who did the movie Not Evil, Just Wrong, they're providing that DVD free to any school system. And they've even come up with lesson plans that they will provide teachers that want to have some balance in the classroom. Now, in the UK, the film can't be shown in school without a warning label pointing out all the errors that a UK court found. I mean, it's kind of like the warning label you see on cigarettes. They have to have a warning label for this movie. But in the U.S., that's not the case. What can parents, if anything, what can they do, if anything, to try to put some balance into this situation within the classroom?
I'm actually glad you asked that question. In many schools, parents get the opportunity with the school boards to discuss what's going to end up being on the curriculum. And then also you can bring to the attention of the board the fact that if you see on your child's syllabus that prior to the beginning of the year, that an Inconvenient Truth is going to be put on there, get on the agenda. Tell them that if they are going to present this, that you want the opposing viewpoint to have equal time, make your demand. Go through that process. Most of the time, the school board always declares that if there's anything of controversy or if there is anything that has an opposing view, we want to basically make sure that both sides are heard. Now, they say that, and hopefully they mean it. But if they don't mean it, you can definitely go through an administrative process to hope and potentially a legal process. And if you've gone through it, you can potentially call Southeastern Legal Foundation and let us know that you're what you're doing, and we can you know, we can help you through the administrative process. Because what you want to do is you want to say, hey, school board, this is not founded in fact. They can point out the information coming out of the UK, and I believe it was either 11 or 15 indicators of misinformation or fraud that were in the Inconvenient Truth that have to be read before it's shown. And then what you do is you say, I want to show this DVD, or I want this lesson plan to be part of it, so that there is a balanced presentation for these children. And make your demand. And you should do that. That's what we should be doing, so that there's balanced information. You do not want your children brainwashed into believing something that is not premised on truth. It's not premised on fact. And you want them to have an informed, an informed experience. And there are lots of resources available. And if you don't know where to find them, you can contact us at southeasternlegal.org. or at epalawsuit.org. Either one, you can get in touch with us, and we can make sure that you have access to the information and the documents to make your challenge. But that's what you should do. You shouldn't tolerate them saying, "Oh no, this is all fact. There's only one viewpoint. It's anthropogenic basis of global warming, and there's actually global warming." Don't accept it. Stand by your values and challenge that school board.
I think that needs to be done. And what's particularly disgusting, and I know a lot of conservatives who feel this way, are the scare tactics being used against the kids. I mean, they've nominated the polar bear as their symbol, and we see the polar bears, on the shrinking piece of ice. And there's actually a ad on treehugger.com. And I have this on my website, Hooterville Gazette.com, where they have a little girl with a noose around her neck standing on a melting block of ice. And the message is very clear: when the ice melts, the little girl dies. And we've seen that being used. We've seen the Build-A-Bear people using Santa Claus to push global warming theory. And frankly, some of the commercials that were being shown in the UK were giving the kids nightmares. Pediatric psychologists and psychiatrists were actually noting an increase in sleep disorders in children because of these trumped-up fears over global warming. So even more so than just having the misinformation in the schools, there are some pretty frightening scare tactics being used to get the kids to buy into this. And I'd like to see we see all kind of ads on late night television for attorneys saying, have you been damaged by this product? Well, you may be entitled to millions and so forth. I'd like to see an attorney, and I've run this by Chris Horner as well, and he made a little skit out of it for YouTube, or at least his organization did. But I'd like to see attorneys saying, is your child having sleep issues due to fears over global warming? If so, you may have a lawsuit against your local school system. I would love to have there be a price to pay for doing this. I mean, because to be honest with you, the school systems are filled with liberals. It starts in kindergarten. It goes all the way up, through college and grad school. That's why I sent my son to private school for 13 years, including kindergarten, because I didn't want him being exposed to that. But it is a huge problem, and I don't think any of the liberals who are controlling the school systems frankly give a darn that the science isn't right. A lot of them are saying, okay, so what? So what if the science is wrong? In the meantime, we clean up the environment. We get rid of that nasty CO2 pollution. So they just don't get it. But the one thing everybody seems to get is a huge settlement that they have to pay or a judgment. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, are there legal grounds for going after a school if a child is experiencing sleep disorders based on fears over global warming?
I'm not sure, but I have to admit that I'm intrigued. I'm not a big fan of, mass torts, and I find it absurd when citizens in an Alaska community are going to sue oil companies and utility companies claiming that their water's rising, so they need to move. It's ridiculous. I'm not even a big fan of two wrongs make a right, but I also think that there is a way we should not be have to protect our children from the school. And if this is a political fight or if this is a legal fight, this is a fight for the adults, all right? And I'm up for it, and you're up for it, and my neighbor's up for it. And anybody who's actually interested in what's going on, you know, in the United States or worldwide is up for that fight. But that's not for our children to be fighting. You're supposed to have safe environments, healthy environments, teach them good, you know, being a good citizen and being a good person and being ethical and being kind. All of those things are what you teach children. Your children are not to be scared. They're not supposed to be afraid to walk outside because, you know, the carbon dioxide. I mean, these are things you're not supposed to do to children. And if that's what's happening, then we're responsible for letting it happen. And liberals or conservatives or independents or whatever they are, whoever's running our schools in our community, they're responsible to us. And that's where our action comes from. And we can handle that as a community. And if they need a lawsuit down the road, I've got no objection to it, but we should be able to manage the principals and the administrators and the teachers in our own school. And if that means your son or your daughter has to stay out of school on the day they teach global warming, that's what we do. Let's boycott Global Warming Day. Let's, you know, make our demand that if you talk about Al Gore or An Inconvenient Truth or carbon dioxide as a poison, then that to me is a political position that doesn't belong in the classroom. And I want my child excluded. You feel I'll come get my, you know, my son or daughter, and I'll take them to the library, and we'll have independent reading. But I don't need my child, and I don't think anybody else needs their child indoctrinated in lies.
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, I would have said there's no way conservatives are going to, you know, stand up and make noise and have that happen, because we just haven't been that vocal as a group. But now, in the wake of the inception of the Tea Party, I think that potential is there. Conservatives who once associated protesting and being activists with, you know, with the only exception possibly being, you know, pro-life people, are now saying, hey, I do need to do this. I don't need to just associate being an activist and being loud and making noise for my cause with being a liberal. I mean, I remember a few, I guess maybe it was about a year and a half, 2 years ago, there was a particular Hollywood star that was, you know, supporting Barack Obama's candidacy, and this highly conservative young woman I know said, oh, gee, I just can't stand that actress. I can't believe she's doing this, and what she's doing is wrong, and you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, so the next time one of her movies comes out, would you participate in a boycott, encourage your friends to boycott this movie, yada, yada, yada? And the response was, oh, my God, no, that's not dignified to do something like that. And I think that's been our problem as conservatives over the years, with the one exception being pro-life movements. We've just been too quiet. And now with the Tea Party movement, I think you've got those people who will go down to the school and say, you know what, I don't want my kid hearing an inconvenient truth. And if you do show it, you better show Not Evil, Just Wrong or The Great Global Warming Swindle or some other movie right beside it, Apocalypse Now by Lord Monckton being another good example. I'm not going to tolerate this school just telling one half of the story.
If you can't stand up for your children, who and what are you going to stand up for? It's the easiest challenge, and I think that we are supposed to not be quiet anymore. I mean, obviously I'm not, but my role is, you know, with Southeastern Legal Foundation, my job is to be out front. Our job is to be out front. We're supposed to be fearless. We're supposed to be talking about the issues that are not yet talked about. But once we identify them, once we're talking to the people about them, once we put the people on notice, then we as a community have an obligation to take action for the protection, if nothing else, to protect your children. And that is the best and most righteous position anybody could ever take.
Well, you know, not to put too much pressure on you, but right now it doesn't seem like Democrats in the Senate are going to have the stomach for a cap and trade law. And frankly, Murkowski took her shot, but unfortunately wasn't able to get it done. And at this point, it looks like if it's going to happen, it being the regulation of CO2, it's going to be through the EPA basically usurping authority that they shouldn't have. And that means that it's going to fall on you and other groups like yours to keep this from happening? I mean, it seems like there's an enormous pressure here on you to essentially save our economy.
There's always an enormous pressure on the public interest community. So we bear it well, we think, and it's worth it to us. We're very lucky. Southeastern Legal Foundation is a charitable non-interest or a nonprofit public interest law firm. We are funded by foundations and individuals throughout the country. We're able to do the work because we receive those contributions, hint, hint to the listeners. And that's the only way we can take on the important cases. And this is but one case that we've taken on. I mean, we're challenging the entire Environmental Protection Agency, i.e. the federal government, for their conduct. We've got suits pending in Alabama, Florida, Georgia, property rights, government accountability, violation of constitution. So we're there and we're standing tall. And that's just the litigations, not to mention the public policy issues that we take on as well. So it's important that people know that, you know, there are public interest law firms and policy centers out there and conservative organizations that are taking action on their behalf. And, you know, find one locally. If you can't find one locally, you know, look up southeasternlegal.org or epalawsuit.org and, you know, make a contribution. It's important to be able to continue the fight. And the only way you do that is, as we know, it's like running a small business or running a business. You've got to have the funds in order to fight the fight. But we're in it for the long haul for certain.
Well, if you hadn't brought it up, I was going to give you a chance before we got off the air to tell people how they can donate, and I should have known you wouldn't have been so shy if you need me to coach you based on other interviews of yours that I've seen. But I tell you what we're going to do. I've got several websites that push conservative causes, and if you have a widget or a little ad or whatever you want, we'll put those up there for free and see if we can encourage our listeners as well as the recipients of our Tea Party Telegram newsletter to help you guys out, because you're certainly doing some good work out there and you deserve the support of people who are benefiting from that work. Now, we do have some extra time available, and if you have a little time available, I'd like to talk to you just a tad bit about the Arizona immigration law, if you can stay on.
Yeah, I can. That'd be great.
Okay, let's head there, because there are so many things about this that are just fascinating, starting with the fact that I'm a radio guy, and I've read the bill. I've got a feeling you've read it too, but we have the Director of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, and Eric Holder, of all people, criticizing this thing and then embarrassingly having to admit that they haven't read it. Now, tell me your suspicions. Why would these two jump on board the criticism bandwagon when they haven't even read the thing?
Oh, well, that's an easy answer. That's because the president said you will. That's, you know, rather than making an intelligent, informed, you know, reality-based decision, just do what the president tells you to do. I act differently myself.
I'm just laughing because there are so many people that voted for the stimulus package without reading it. So many politicians who voted for the health care bill without reading it. We've got two top level Obama officials saying that the Arizona bill was bad, and they haven't read it. Now let's kind of dive into the bill a little bit, because it's interesting that what we heard for weeks were, all these charges of racial profiling. But when you look at the suit that the Justice Department is bringing against the state of Arizona, there is really nothing in there about racial profiling, is there?
No, there isn't. This is it is very specifically about the decisions that the federal government make and why they should preempt a state's rights. And it's interesting because it's utterly contrary to it's contrary to common sense, and it's contrary to state sovereignty. And they're basically saying that federal authority and law on issues of immigration and status of aliens trumps anything going on in the state. But that's interesting because
there about sanctuary. Is there a footnote there about sanctuary cities?
I did not see the sanctuary city footnote. looking at that.
Oh,
that's funny. Are you being funny?
I'm sorry.
That's nice.
Yeah, I was attempting that. When you got to explain them, they're not that good.
Well, you know, and what's really funny, I'll tell you what, as of, was it yesterday? Let me think. No, as of the 14th, 3 days ago, there is actually a request for the state of Michigan, Florida, Alabama, Nebraska, North Mariana Islands, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, and Virginia to be able to file amici briefs, friends of the court briefs, on behalf of Arizona. So they're taking the side of Arizona. And interestingly, it's kind of like, you know, strange bedfellows.
Are these the amicus friend of the court briefs that we've been hearing about?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And you're also, I think, did I say, yeah, Florida's in there as
Texas.
Well. And
Texas.
Yeah, Texas as well. I mean, so you're basically getting the states that are affected by illegal aliens and illegal immigration. And but they're speaking, they're going to be...
I understand that's not PC.
Well, what's really nice is I can say whatever I want, and I don't care about being politically correct. Being right and being correct, I care about, but I don't care about someone's perception of how I should talk, when I should talk, and under what circumstances. I'm a free woman. I'm going to do whatever I darn well please.
You go, girl. I'm sorry. I've gotten off track with that. I sincerely apologize. One of the things that I was hoping you would do, because I find it so hypocritical when you compare the Arizona law to the federal law in terms of prevention of racial profiling and protection of the individual, could you sort of highlight some of the differences between the federal law, the existing federal law, and the Arizona law in terms of which one it has the greater potential for racial profiling and which one might be a greater violator of individual rights?
Well, it's no doubt that, I mean, the federal law is a much more potential of abuse and profiling, and the fact that they always declared that they're not going to racially profile. Arizona's law has been very narrowly tailored. And let me just step back for just a minute. Let's talk about abuse. Abuse comes from a couple of different things. It comes from hierarchy, which means if the powers that be say we shall abuse, then the underlings who don't stand up for them, you can have abuse. Then you also have what I call the independent actor who can be abusive. You are going to see that no matter what, under any circumstances. What we want to have in our law enforcement community is good training, good training, good training. And when there's good training, good training, good training, and good supervision, then you're going to have a smaller number of abuses because power often breeds abuse. So you want to be able to control that. But the way that Arizona tailored their law and the manner in which they've basically given direction, if you will, to the law enforcement community is righteous. And there is no sound foundation in fact that would indicate there was an intention to abuse, and pardon my use of the word, or alienate our legal immigrants, or to do damage to that relationship. And for there to be this mass response, not based on fact and not based on a good reading of the Arizona law, is kind of amusing, to say the least. And that's the exact response of the federal government. They're preying on the misinformation that was being disclosed. And with all due respect, we have a very diverse community in the United States. That's where we come from. We are a melting pot. We are accepting. Do we have social ills? Yes. Do we try to deal with them? Yes. Are we perfect? No. But there is not anyone who is being subjected to abuse as a result of this law. And people who have been through the legal process are the ones that are voicing their support for this the most. When you stand in line in another country and say, I want to be in America, and you wait your turn, and you go through all of the steps and you get here, and some schmuck down the street drag, you know, their entire family across the border, and they get all the benefits and all the rights that after you stood in line, I assure you that person is not happy. And that's what if you talk to the people who have been through the process who are legal, they care. People who are already American citizens, maybe they have a different political perspective, But the people that we should be listening to are the people who are actually going through the immigration process legally, who value their relationship with the United States when they become legal immigrants and or they become American citizens. They're the ones who are standing with the Tea Party. They're the ones who are standing up in Arizona saying, yes, I want to be protected from illegal immigration. I want you to handle this situation. And Arizona, you know, let's face it, Arizona and Arizona's governor stepped up. And I have a feeling that the Department of Justice is going to have an uphill battle, as they should.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to be honest, I wish the timing were after this November, because I think this certainly has energized the Hispanic portion of the Democratic base. But she did it when she did it. She did it when she had to go forward. And, yes, she is standing up. And how embarrassing that Napolitano from Arizona seems to have forgotten everything she learned while she was there. Let me ask you something that I think is kind of interesting because it combines both of our issues here today. Do you find it amusing at all, as I do, that Democrats claim that passing cap and trade is a matter of national security, but apparently enforcing our borders is not?
If I actually laughed, if I didn't think of the seriousness and the implications of what they do and what they say, I'd probably be laughing most of the time because the absurdity and the hypocrisy of the statements, with all due respect, they need to actually pay attention to what's going on, and they actually have to give credit to the electorate that we have good common sense, and statements like that that are just stupid shouldn't be made. And you're going to be looking at 80, 85, 90% of the American people are supportive of Arizona's efforts. Anybody who lives in a community that has the detrimental effect of illegal immigration and illegal aliens is going to be supportive of Arizona. And there isn't one community in the United States that's not being affected by it. That doesn't make us anti-Hispanic. That doesn't make us anti-anything other than we're anti-criminal conduct. And that's exactly what you're talking about. You're talking about violating the law in order to get here because it's what you wanted. It's a violation of federal law to come across the border and be here and or stay past your visa, period. So you're breaking the law by doing that. And so what respect should I give you? What protection should I give you? I shouldn't give you any. What I should be worried about is myself, my family, my community, and the people who are here legally have the same values. And that's what Congress should be focused on. That's what the Democrats should be focused on. And I don't think you're going to see as much of an uptick as you would think, because I think the Hispanic community, the legal Hispanic community, the voting Hispanic community knows that this law and any law ordinance that's passed is not anti-Hispanic. It's basically anti-criminal.
I agree with you now, but I would argue that there are demonstrations taking place in Arizona, and some of those people, I mean, all of those people appear to be legal citizens. I mean, that's not one big group of illegal immigrants holding up those signs, is it? I mean, aren't there some people who are legally here that are supporting of the illegals that are here?
You are, and don't misunderstand. There is no doubt that this is controversial, and that there are strong opinions one way or the other. The liberal community that is against this is highly motivated, highly vocal, not afraid to demonstrate. As you've mentioned, it's taken us a little while to figure out that demonstrating actually works and is something that we can do in good conscience. And they're much more primed to do it. So yeah, they're going to demonstrate and they're going to object. It doesn't mean they're going to win politically. It doesn't mean they're going to win under the law, but they are letting their, you know, voices be heard, as they should. That's what a democracy and a republic is all about. Let your voice be heard. If they are against Arizona's law, let it be heard. A majority of the Arizonans are actually for it, so they're probably going to lose, but it's important for us to hear the voices of the people, no matter, you know, what they have to say. I've got no objection to somebody demonstrating and saying, hey, I don't like Arizona's law. I think they're wrong. I'm allowed to say so. I certainly, and the part I disagree most is, the federal government, the Department of Justice. I mean, how dare you? If you're not going to enforce federal law, then the states are going to have to protect their own.
You seem to be reading my mind, because that actually provides a segue to my next question when you said not enforcing federal law. What did you make of John Morton, who heads ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement people, stating that, and let me read this because I can't believe this was said, his agency will not necessarily process illegal immigrants referred to them by Arizona officials. Here we have the top ICE official saying, you know, I don't think I'm going to do my job.
Well, you know, it's interesting because across the board, and this is national, federal, local, everybody who knows anything about law enforcement knows that law enforcement acts on basically 100% discretion. So law enforcement has 100% discretion. Prosecutors pretty much have 100% discretion. So what we do is we trust people's training to make good decisions out in the field. So you can't say, hey, by the way, you've got to arrest that person. What the police officer has to do is investigate, determine if there's been a law that's been violated, and under what circumstances he should arrest or take action. Okay, we rely on that every day. Sometimes they do a good job, sometimes they don't. Sometimes we have to sue to make sure they do a good job. In this particular situation, it offends even that sense of discretion, because they've already tried to take away Sheriff Arpaio's qualifications and certification under ICE. Politics again. Politics intruding on law enforcement. Politics intruding on good, sound policy. It's not supposed to happen that way. And that's what's happened here, is them for them to announce, they're basically questioning the veracity and the commitment of the law enforcement community in Arizona to abide by the Arizona Constitution and the United States Constitution. How dare you? If you have special circumstances, if you find a case where somebody who has abused someone's rights or you shouldn't enforce something, I have no objection to the head of ICE. I have no objection to the United States Attorney General. I have no objection to anybody taking action and saying this situation is unacceptable and we are not going to enforce. I'm okay with that as on an individual basis, but for them to suggest that the law enforcement community in the entire state of Arizona is somehow corrupt is so offensive to my very beliefs in the local government, local control, and support of our law enforcement as well as our military community. How dare you?
Well, when I heard that statement, I didn't think for one minute that he was suggesting he was going to take it on a case-by-case basis when he said he will not necessarily process. I really felt he was in one fell swoop saying that he may not necessarily process any of them that are referred to him, but he was speaking in totality with that. So very, very disturbing. I can't for the life of me figure out why there hasn't been more of this made in the mainstream media, federal officials saying he's not going to do his job. I want to move on to one more issue. We've got about 7 minutes remaining, and then I'm going to hit a hard break, and we will have to end the show. The fairness doctrine, obviously important to me. I find it interesting that if your particular political viewpoints can't draw an audience on national radio, the solution is to legally require people to listen to a point of view that they don't want to hear. There's a reason why Air America didn't succeed. Frankly, most of the Democrats I know aren't informed about anything. If you saw John Ziegler's film, they didn't know who Nancy Pelosi was. They didn't know who Barney Frank was. They didn't know who Harry Reid was. They stay uninformed, and they like it that way. That's why whenever you go to a bookstore, you see books by Rush and Sean Hannity and Ann Coulter, you know, in prominent positions, selling like hotcakes, and all the stuff by Al Franken and others like him, you know, they're in the discount bin where you can buy them for $2. Liberals act on emotion, not on fact. So talk to me about the Fairness Doctrine. Do you think there's any chance in the world that we're going to see that invade our lives on talk radio?
I know we have to stay informed about it. Let me just say that. And I know we have to be prepared for action. But it goes – even with all of the things that are going on at the federal government level and the administration, it doesn't make sense to me that they're going to be able to make any ground on this. And I'm assuming that the people who are listening know what the Fairness Doctrine is. Basically, it says that if you if one viewpoint is heard, whether it be a nonprofit or profit, a radio, that the opposing viewpoint has to be heard. And that's where you talk about the fact that Air America went under and they would force somebody to be on with you to talk about things that are contrary to your perspective or my perspective, for example. And I just don't see it happening. It's a silly concept in many, many ways, especially for public consumption. We're talking about for-profit endeavors. And I know we need to stay aware of it. I know we need to keep talking about it so that we don't lose sight of the fact that there can be manipulations going on and amendments and bills that might shock us when they come out. But I don't see it. It's just completely and totally unreasonable. But I would like to – let's go full circle back to when we were talking about the school board, if you don't mind 2 seconds. Go back to the school board when you're talking about the inconvenient truth being shown and they're putting – global climate change on the syllabus. One of the things that most school boards declare is it's the equivalent of the fairness doctrine. They say that all controversial issues have to give fair and equal time. Hold them accountable for that. Having a fairness doctrine in a school environment that on controversial issues, see, that makes perfect sense to me. It's a public environment. Children are being affected. They should hear equal viewpoints. People should be invited in that can discuss something that's controversial or that everybody doesn't agree on. Makes good sense to me. But I'm an adult. I can pick and choose what radio station I want to listen to. I can pick and choose who I want to watch on television, who I want to hear on the radio. I don't need any help from the federal government to become informed. And that's really what it's about. They want to manipulate and brainwash and serve up propaganda as a federal mandate. And we're not going to have it. I don't see it happening. I'm staying vigilant. I know you're staying vigilant, but I don't think it's going to happen.
I think it's interesting that there's a clip circulating around YouTube of Dan Rather suggesting that the federal government, I think, needs to help the failing newspaper industry. That I'm paraphrasing, but it's interesting that people are calling for the President of the United States, who was elected in part because of this enormous support he got from the left-stream media, to bail out these organizations that are now losing money because people are tired of them taking such a biased position. It's sort of like, hey, the mainstream media got me elected, and we're going to have to do something to prop up the liberal voice, because liberal points of view on their own can't draw a radio audience, can't sell newspapers, and that would be devastating to the Democrats. So therefore, we're going to have to take various legal actions, bail these people out, pass the fairness doctrine. I mean, essentially, they don't have confidence that their point of view can be packaged and have advertising sold around it. So I just find it interesting that this is so obvious that I don't know why most people can't figure out what's going on. It just seems obvious to me.
You're preaching to the choir on this one. And, I don't see the federal government, not that we would accept it, I don't see the federal government saying, hey, let's give money to Southeastern Legal Foundation so they can be on, have their own radio station like NPR, so we can actually report about the world and report about national politics, and we can report about, Supreme Court cases coming down. I mean, I don't see that happening. When they want to, throw some money our way, and we'll decline it, but when they actually want equal time, then they can do that on NPR. But leave the for-profit, radio stations and radio shows alone.
We only have about 2 minutes left, but one quick question. Obviously, the new Black Panther Party has been in the news a lot over the last several days, really over the last 2 weeks. And since you're a constitutional attorney, my question regards free speech. One of the things that I've found, in fact, I've posted kind of a compilation video on YouTube, is just numerous instances of members of the new Black Panther Party saying that they want to kill white people. And oftentimes they show up in public and they're all carrying shotguns in states where you can carry a shotgun if you point it up in the air. Does that all fall within free speech, just having a big gathering and say we need to kill white people and we need to kill white babies? I mean, is that a free speech issue?
It potentially is a free speech issue, and I've seen some of what you're talking about in terms of the rallies. I assure you that if another demographic conducted themselves in that manner, action would be taken across the board in terms of law enforcement and federal action. to curtail such activity. There are laws restricting certain conduct that have been found constitutional in the free speech arena, causing a riot, encouraging murder, mayhem, death. You have to take them based on circumstances. To what extent are these rallies and or this conduct, is it actually promoting and is it resulting in the death of white people? Because some of these issues have also been dealt with legally with Nazi parties and white supremacist parties, Ku Klux Klan situations, being able to rally, being able to have parades, being able to declare their beliefs. Yeah, I understand.
I'm going to have to cut you off. We're about to sign off the air. I want to thank you for being here, and we would love to have you back someday.
Oh, we look forward to it. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks, Shannon.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.